This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyik, and my co-host for the Doctor in the House segment this rainy Friday afternoon, Dr.
Not
George
quite
Lee.
Yet. About to rain.
It is pouring out there
already.
Oh, it is pouring now.
You're right.
You brought the rain and the clouds.
I know. Last day of the month and also last day of the quarter. Can you believe it?
That's right. Time flies. And we are discussing something that has been in the news actually since December of last year. A lot of heated debate going on around it.
It's very, to say the least,
controversial. It's about PrEP or pre-exposure prophylaxis. Now, in medical terms, it has been hailed as being life-saving. It is highly effective in preventing HIV, especially, of course, when it's taken as prescribed by medical professionals. And in fact, here in Malaysia, recently, Deputy Health Minister Lukan Isman Awang Sauni said that the Ministry of Health will actually be further expanding a pilot program which will see PrEP being dispensed for free in certain clinics. But, like we were saying, the controversy over this is that there are some parties that say that sexual abstinence should be emphasized instead of prescribing PrEP, which within those circles, they are arguing that it is seen to encourage risky behaviors, especially among men who have sex with men. So joining us today, George, to clear the air over the use of PrEP and its role in bringing down the transmission of HIV is Associate Professor Dr. Raja Iskandar Raja Azwa, Consultant Infectious Diseases Physician and President of the Malaysian AIDS Council. Dr. Iskandar, thank you so much for joining us. How are you?
Thanks very much for having me today. I'm very well, thank you.
So call us with your questions if you have thoughts and concerns over this issue. The number to call is 03-7733-2900. You can WhatsApp our U mobile number at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. So much discussion over PrEP, Dr. Iskandar. But perhaps let's get the technicalities, the basic stuff out of the way first to understand what we're talking about. What exactly is pre-exposure prophylaxis? And when we say it can actually prevent the transmission of the virus HIV, how does it do that?
Right. So PrEP is not really groundbreakingly new. It's been around since 2010, that's when some of the earlier studies from the US started, where it started to show efficacy in terms of prevention of HIV. So really where this discussion is probably coming along, you know, maybe 10 years behind, because that's when it first showed efficacy. So HIV pre-exposure prophylaxis is simply it's medication, either in the form of an oral pill, or now you can get an injection, although not available locally at the moment, which is taken, so if it's an oral pill, it's taken on a daily basis or in relation to exposure for men. For women, you have to take it daily to prevent HIV. So it's very much in line with other pre-exposure prophylaxis medications like malarial prophylaxis, the oral contraceptive pill, you know, to prevent a disease subsequently or to prevent pregnancy. So it is not something, it's not a new concept in the context of medicine, widely practiced before. I think the controversy around it, of course, is that because of its connection with HIV and certain related behaviours associated with how you get HIV. So PrEP, on a long shot, it's highly safe, okay, very little side effects. You may essentially get a bit of nausea when you start it for 1 or 2 days. It can be associated with problems with kidney function in people with high risk factors for chronic kidney disease, like hypertension, diabetes, in smokers. But otherwise, it's a very safe drug. And in terms of efficacy, it's highly effective at preventing HIV. So more than 99% at preventing HIV. So to me, the question is, why haven't we sort of scaled it up at this stage already, rather than having these discussions about why we are trying to prevent access to this highly preventative drug or scale up.
Absolutely. And when you say more than 99% effective, I mean, there are very few things in medicine where you can, you know, cite a figure like that, isn't it? But how does it compare against the other preventive methods that are also, you know, in that basket, the use of condoms, abstinence, right, which is the other thing that comes up.
Yeah, so for years we relied on condoms, okay? I mean, abstinence is one of the tools, of course, to prevent HIV, but should not really be the only tool. I mean, in reality, the reason why we have teenage pregnancies at an earlier age is mm-hmm. because people don't practice abstinence. And that's the reality of life, right? And that's a whole discussion in itself. And people experiment at a younger age and get themselves into difficult situations. So in terms of what's in the HIV prevention toolbox, so for a long time, we relied largely on condoms. And if you can imagine, from where we are 30 years ago to now, condoms and abstinence has been probably some of the messages we've passed out in terms of preventing HIV. There are others, of course. So if you go into HIV treatment early, your viral load becomes undetectable. You don't pass on the HIV sexually. So that's also a form mm-hmm. of HIV prevention. But what is good about PrEP is that it relies on the HIV negative partner taking charge. Now, condoms, very good, should be advocated. It's really probably for, you know, a select group of people who, for some reason, are not using condoms or who cannot or who choose not to use condoms for a multitude of reasons. Now, comparatively, if you compare PrEP and condoms, PrEP essentially is higher and is more effective than condoms. Because condoms, if you think about it, rely on the person putting on the condom at a time of, a heated moment, and it depends on the other partner. And often the partners who are at risk may not be able to negotiate condom use. Mm-hmm. And so PrEP involves taking, for example, in this country, it would involve taking a pill when you're not involved in the exposure as yet. You're adequately build up your drug levels and you are protected by the time you're exposed.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I mean, what constitutes PrEP itself? What sort of antiviral are they?
So it's a antiretroviral drug called Truvada. So it's a combination of two drugs, tenofovir and emtricitabine. That is the drug that is available in this country. We soon will have another formulation, which is a more kidney-friendly version, called tenofovir elafenamide FTC or TAF. And of course, there are clinical trials now to demonstrate the effectiveness and efficacy of injectable PrEP. That's mm-hmm. that's another drug called cabotegravir. But that, in terms of when we will eventually see that in this country, is going to probably take a couple of years, mm-hmm. not until 2027 yeah, at okay. least.
I mean, you mentioned, I mean, the name PrEP itself, say, pre-exposure.
Yeah.
Presumably, there are three groups of people who would benefit from this. One is that the one who accidentally or suddenly had an exposure that is unintended. Presumably, that group of patients is crucially important. There's some sort of window period, which I'm going to come back to you. Second group is presumably HIV positive individuals need to take the medication in order to suppress that. But that itself is not PrEP, really, is it? And then lastly, the partner of the HIV positive person and then having control, like you said. Can you tell me the differences between the dosage or the type of drugs that will be allocated for these three groups of individuals?
Yep. Okay. So maybe just to clarify, I think just for clarification reasons, you have post-exposure prophylaxis. So that's medication that you can take when you are exposed to HIV within 72 hours and you're at risk of HIV infection. So that's one. And that involves taking antiretroviral drugs, a combination of three drugs, for a period of 28 days.
28 days.
So that's post-exposure prophylaxis, after the exposure, not pre-exposure. Then you have pre-exposure prophylaxis as mentioned, and then you have treatment as prevention, which relies on the HIV positive person taking antiretroviral treatment and maintains an undetectable viral load, which essentially means that the level of the virus in the blood is so low it cannot be detected by the assay, during which case there's zero risk of sexual transmission. Now, if somebody is HIV negative and is married or is linked or is a partner of a HIV positive partner and he or she's undetectable, there's no need to take PrEP.
Right.
Because the risk is zero of transmission, provided that the viral load remains suppressed. So, I mean, the groups that you essentially are targeting are in this country are those at a higher risk of HIV infection, and they include men who have sex with men, sex workers, and transgendered women, and also partners of HIV-positive partners who are not virally suppressed. Mm-hmm. The doses that you asked were essentially for daily PrEP, you take one pill once a day, but not everybody necessarily needs to take that. Depending on essentially how often the exposures occur. So for men, the option is you can also take it on a non-daily basis, so on demand, and involves taking two pills, 2 to 24 hours before the exposure, one pill 24 hours after that, and one pill 24 hours after that, and then you stop. So four right. pills per exposure. Now, wouldn't that be great if you had that for oral contraception, you know, for women?
For men as well.
For men as well, yes, yes, absolutely, yes. But we still haven't got daily contraption for men yet. So, you know, but I'm just, so I think
it's a personal gripe of mine. but you know what, I do want to follow up on the point you made about which groups are at highest risk of, especially, I think, sexual transmission of HIV. You mentioned men who have sex with men, sex workers, the transgender community. But we'll go for a quick break first, and then we'll come back and discuss stigma that relates to the behaviors and practices and therefore their ability to access something like PrEP, which, as you said, could be, it's more than 99% effective in preventing HIV transmission. And why are we still seeing new HIV cases? You know, really, this could be something that could be wiping out HIV from the face of the earth. Call us with your questions, 03773 2900, WhatsApp U mobile number 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. My co-host, Dr. George Lee, in the studio with me, together with Associate Professor Dr. Raja Iskandar Raja Azwa, Consultant Infectious Diseases Physician and President of the Malaysian AIDS Council. We'll be right back after this break on Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Shao-Ik, and my co-host, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, is our doctor in the house segment today. We are joined by Associate Professor Dr. Raja Iskandar Raja Azwa, consultant infectious diseases physician and president of the Malaysian AIDS Council. We're discussing HIV today, but specifically the use of PrEP or pre-exposure prophylaxis to prevent the transmission of HIV, especially among some key populations. The name itself says it all. It is something that prevents prophylaxis before you are exposed to whatever is the you know, that point of transmission of the virus, and it is more than 99% effective in preventing transmission of the virus. So really, Dr. Iskandar, why are we not seeing the virus really? Why are we not seeing numbers reducing dramatically? If I can cite 2021's numbers in Malaysia, we had over 2,700 newly reported cases, and that's still significant considering we have something like this in our arsenal.
And that's probably also unreported, given the fact that that sort of happened during COVID times and people were testing less. So, you know, there are a lot of things that we can do better in terms of public health. HIV testing, making HIV testing accessible to not just key populations, but anybody. I mean, let me throw the question back to you. When did you last have an HIV test, if ever?
Is it part of your pre-marriage?
Well, for Muslims, yes, but not necessarily. It's only in this country, it's only targeted, you know, to...
And there's so much stigma around that, and fear and taboo associated with that, isn't it?
Yeah, and the problem with that is that the fear of HIV has been so deeply ingrained from about 30 years ago. You know, the messages about it's a killer disease, and it's how hugely stigmatized you will be if you caught HIV. Those messages really haven't changed much throughout the years, despite the fact that we've had huge advances in HIV treatment, and that is in the press. I mean, you know, but the general public awareness still remains very low. So I think the problem is people are not testing as often. Okay, the number of places where people feel they can go to test and feel safely and not judge have to increase. But there's a lot of good work which is done by both the Malaysian AIDS Council and the Ministry of Health in community-based testing. So going to NGOs or communities and getting tested there by people who look like them, who think like them. So that's the way forward, community-based testing.
Is it because the consequence of positive tests and the impact of it, not just in the physical health, but, you know, how would Ministry of Health handle them and how would their records being handled? And people have that sort of fear. Do you not think that is essentially... So what happened if somebody who electively have themselves tested positive? What happened to that individual according to Malaysian law? What do the clinicians have to do?
Right, so after somebody gets diagnosed, if you subsequently go to a public healthcare facility, and in fact, any healthcare facility is required by law by the clinician to report and mm-hmm. notify the disease. Now, the infection is reported with IC and name and details of the patient, but it is used largely for statistical purposes. Mm-hmm. And so that's where it ends. There is partner notification as well, as a result of notification. So then somebody will contact the patient to ensure that any regular partners or spouses are tested. So it's mm-hmm. for statistical purposes, so you have the numbers, as well as largely for partner notification, which is essential for public health interventions and interrupting the transmission of infections. Mm-hmm. That's good. But I think what people are more concerned about is this almost abnormal or irrational fear that this data is going to be used against them. And there's no truth in that, mm-hmm. okay? There is respect of confidentiality and that data is safe. Mm-hmm. I think people often worry about that.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and probably a bit unnecessarily so. Yeah.
Yeah. And I want to bring in the key populations. Are men who have sex with men, sex workers and transgender contributing a significant proportion to new infections? And, you know, we call them a high-risk group because it's not just the nature of the profession or the behaviors, right? It's also the stigma that they face. And from there, are they able to practice prevention, access the strategies that are available?
Yeah, you know, it's always very careful. You have to be careful what we say sometimes, mm-hmm. particularly when it comes to how information is disseminated. And I always, we always need to be careful when we're reporting, because for fear even when we say, let's say, key populations and certain key populations are more likely to be affected by HIV, you know, people get worried and it's often blown out of context. But the reality of it is, yes, key populations in this country are disproportionately affected by HIV, and a lot of HIV prevention focus is towards them. Sexual transmission now contributes to more than 95% of new cases of mm-hmm. HIV. And the predominant new cases are in men who have sex with men. So that's where our focus largely has to be directed. But it is very difficult in this country. Talking about sex is very difficult. You know, George may be very good at it, but, you know, not everybody can be George, right? And feel very free in that space to talk about it. But given the platform, people want to be able to talk about it, and that's the difference, right? Mm-hmm. So, yes. And so, therefore, within this scenario, people don't often, key populations don't feel as accepted, particularly in healthcare settings, you know? And I'm so sorry to speak for my profession, but I think the amount of stigma that is directed towards key population are almost probably the worst that come from healthcare workers. And we've seen that play out also in the media of late. Mm-hmm. People put their own judgments, whether it's religious or otherwise, ahead of what they are supposed to do as a doctor and treat everybody irrespective of sexual orientation, gender, race, religion.
Dress code,
absolutely. You know, I mean, it's simple. You treat everybody equally. I don't understand when people deviate from that.
Mm, yeah. You know, what are the misconceptions that people have about PrEP and that is that that has been what has contributed to all these controversies, right? And the discrimination that, you know, as you've said, exists among healthcare workers even. What kind of misconceptions would you like to set straight about the use of PrEP and whether or not, you know, that belief that it will encourage more risk, high-risk behaviours, is that true?
So we've been here before in history with multiple other public health interventions. We've been here with the oral contraceptive pill in the 1960s. We've been here with HPV vaccination and the concerns amongst parents who want to vaccinate their kids that it may encourage them to have, you know, premarital sex. We've been through this with the harm reduction program, and that's involving needle syringe programs and opioid substitution therapy as a means to prevent HIV to injecting drug users. The concern there was, you know, they were concerned that people will end up, you know, injecting drug use more. So I think the point to understand is that history is repeating itself here. Mm-hmm. And so we need to go back and learn our mistakes from what we did in the past with other public health interventions and conversations around this. So this concept and this whole conversation of risk compensation, which is what I call it, and that is the concern around that, the concern that sexual behaviours may be risky sexual behaviours may increase due to an effective public health intervention is needs to be discussed at length. So the concern, of course, that's played out in the media is that PrEP will increase condomless sex or particularly around certain key populations that we're targeting. There is no evidence around that. People will have sex irrespective, okay, is whether you choose to want to be able to offer people the correct protection before they have sex. That is ultimately it. So, I think the discussion around there is, and some of what has also played out is that, I mean, you know, that will encourage more people to become gay. I mean, that's even something which, you know, does not pan out because you're either born gay or you're otherwise, you don't become gay because of a HIV prevention strategy. And, people may end up choosing one HIV prevention over other. So if then they then choose to not use condoms because they feel effectively protected by PrEP, well, then so be it. PrEP is highly effective at preventing HIV. But the focus there is HIV. It doesn't pretend to protect against sexually transmitted infections. Mm. And that would be the benefit of using condoms and PrEP together.
Yeah, that's right. Mm.
So in summary, what you're saying is that PrEP is highly, highly efficacious. It's has minimal adversity. And then out of all these populations that are infected every year, the vast majority are key population and the vast majority of key population are men. At the end of the day, it's discrimination and also bias towards men having sex with men that actually is the key that is stopping these highly effective drugs being distributed to these men. What can change? I mean, this is mindset that actually, like you said, it hasn't changed for the last 50 years or so. So how do we have a solution? Because it's almost feel like a gridlock that it's the discrimination that stopped a key group of people getting life-saving medications.
Yeah, okay. So, I think, first of all, I think we need to, for example, in where I work, University of Malaya Medical Center, we've been providing PrEP since 2015. Mm-hmm. It's never been
free of charge.
And no, but it's 30 ringgit per month. So it's 1 ringgit a day. So we've been doing that and it's never been an issue. But people don't really want to come to the hospital. Preventative services are generally done very badly in this country and people want to access preventable services generally in a community-based settings where it's accessible, it's going to be quick, they come in, they come out, because it's not complicating. Providing and dispensing PrEP is very easy, very much like the contraception. You need some safety labs, but, you know, otherwise it's pretty easy. I think we just need to ensure that the environment which is providing these HIV prevention strategies are staffed by people who have a similar mindset, who look like the people who are coming forward for PrEP, and to give a sense that that people are not going to be judged for coming forward. Now, it's easier said than done. It is down to how you look. It's down to verbal behavior. It's what signs are displayed, and it's what language you use to address people. And ultimately, it's all down to that, I think, you know?
So on that basis, can an individual who know that they are high risk actually ask for their healthcare provider to give them such medications for the PrEP itself without going to the hospitals?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, where PrEP should be dispensed is in the public sector. And there is for over the past 5 years, a lot of the focus of PrEP dispensing was largely from the private sector. So you have something called preplocator.com, which will give you a list of all the clinics which provide PrEP nationally. Mm-hmm. And that started out initially mainly as private clinics, but now has also involved some clinics in the national program as well. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think, and these clinics have been chosen largely on the basis that they are key population friendly or have worked with key populations. So the key populations who want to access PrEP should really not be afraid that they will encounter, you know, stigmatizing attitudes as they go to these clinics. And that's a hope.
Presumably, it was only price disparity between the private and the public sectors.
Yeah. So the public sector in the national program at the moment, it's the funds are being provided by Global Fund. And that's for free at the moment, over a period of 2 years at the moment. Okay. So that's free. PrEP in the private sector varies anything between 55 ringgit to about 140-150 ringgit per month. Mm-hmm. And so there's a wide range, but it is in the order of that. So there is, yes, obviously a price disparity between the two.
Can you put to bed this argument that, you know, offering PrEP in the public sector will be economically exorbitant compared to abstinence, which obviously some people will say, well, you know, that's free.
Free of charge.
Yeah, okay. I mean, once again, sexual abstinence is one of the many prevention tools. And I know some certain groups will strongly believe in it and advocate it as the only HIV prevention. Never have we dispelled it as a form of HIV prevention strategy. But we know that programs who use sexual abstinence only will never achieve what they want to achieve at the end in terms of prevention of infection. This case is HIV. We need to use all the tools within our toolbox. PrEP, as it is in this country, it's available in the generic form. It's actually relatively cheap. Mm. You know, it is so cheap compared to other countries. So economically, there's a huge case for it. Even if you scale it up to the thousands, it's still the life compared to the lifetime cost of having to treat somebody with HIV is immensely more. And so clearly on a cost-effective analysis, you get your money's worth if you still invest in prevention here.
So in an ideal setting, obviously it's provided for free. But in a way, like you mentioned, that the cost itself is not phenomenal. Mm. So people who are key population who are at risk will have access to it anyway by default, right? If the cost is not too prohibiting. In some way, that is the way to bypass all that bias and mindsets of people who discriminate against them.
Yes, but it's also an opportunity to work with the public sector and particularly Ministry of Health to you know, in terms of reducing the stigma. I mean, Ministry of Health often sometimes get a bad press in terms of, you know, I think working with key populations. But they've done immensely well with this. You know, I think in terms of working with key populations, trying to reduce stigma, you are able to change some people. I think the biggest I think the biggest way to change people, and we experience this with our own medical students, is to expose people to what they're stigmatized against. And the more exposure they have, the less likely they are to stigmatize. So, for example, in UMMC, when we give lectures to our students on HIV, and maybe sexual orientation, we get somebody from the community and a person living with HIV to talk to them.
Mm.
And that degree of exposure always makes people realize there is, you know, there's a human behind the disease. And I think it goes a long way rather than just, you know, rather than just telling people what to do. I think you need to give a human side of the disease.
Yeah.
Hearing the lived and the living experience.
Of course, yeah.
Makes a big difference to how you... Ultimately, these are people who could one day walk into your clinic and need your care.
Absolutely. And we forget that these people are somebody's sons, daughters, grandmothers, you know. Mm. We never live in isolation.
Absolutely. And on that note, I want to go for a quick break, but come back to get you to share more about how that stigma really affects these individuals when they're walking into a hospital to seek treatment or to get tested, or they're trying to get access to prophylaxis like PrEP. In reality, on the ground, what kinds of behaviors and attitudes do they face? How does that affect their outcomes? We are speaking today to Associate Professor Dr. Raja Iskandar Raja Azwar, Consultant Infectious Diseases Physician and President of the Malaysian AIDS Council. I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. George Lee, and we will be right back on Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Shawik. I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist and associate professor, Dr. Raja Iskandar Raja Azwar, president of the Malaysian AIDS Council and consultant infectious diseases physician. We're discussing PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis, and how important it is in reducing HIV transmission. You can call us with your questions, 03-7733-2900. You would have been following, of course, the news and some of the heated debates about the expansion of PrEP, the pilot program to provide PrEP in selected public clinics. So call us if you have any thoughts to share, or you can WhatsApp our U-Mobile number 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Dr. Iskandar, before the break, I left off just touching a little bit on stigma, right? And you have brought up that that is a huge barrier. What does that actually look like for individuals who are faced with that stigma?
Yeah, I think, I mean, stigma, just to first of all recognize that stigma just doesn't exist. It exists in other branches of medicine, for example, stigma against mental health, stigma against...
people with disabilities.
People with disabilities, exactly. Yeah, right. So it's not unique to HIV. But I think if people feel... So there's various forms of stigma. There is stigma that the patient feels before he even walks into the clinic because he may have a disease or infection. He may feel stigmatized because of the way he acts, the way he moves, the way he appears, the way he dresses. There's stigma because of the of who he is, who he or she is attracted to. So there's... And there's what he feels, what he anticipates, what is actually realized. And then there's intersectional stigma that, you know, so which there's intersections at various angles. But what it does essentially is that it delays HIV testing, it delays HIV treatment, it prevents people from continuing on HIV treatment if they're positive, and it just prevents people from accessing services. Now, I think once again, you know, although stigma exists, there are a lot of tools to try and make that better. And that is, and one clear way is sharing lived experiences of people with an infection disease and getting your clinic staffed by people who look like them and who think like them.
You know, stigma, you said, and I think you were very candid about how stigma exists among healthcare workers, but really it's everywhere in society, right? And I think a significant influential voice is also from certain stakeholders and community leaders like religious leaders. And, you know, in fact, the Selangor Mufti Department, I think it was when the controversy happened last month as well, you know, related PrEP to colluding in sin, right? And it's these are the kinds of things that when they break out in the news, they can skew the conversation in a certain direction. And as healthcare professionals, you know, what can you do? It's not really an area that you know, it's within your purview, but it affects the care that you can provide.
I always go back to the science, and if the science is strong, that's what we should fall back on. We had those issues with the harm reduction. We were having these issues with PrEP. I think people need to be quite clear about the evidence behind PrEP in reducing HIV transmission. Now, right from the beginning, Malaysia has always been very good and instrumental in getting religious leaders part of that conversation, because they have a large voice, and what they say matters. Sometimes they can do harm, and there is a recognition of that. But I think continual engagement with them as part of the many stakeholders within the HIV response is essential. Maybe we could have done that a bit sooner. Maybe we could have I think maybe that could have been done a bit sooner or along the journey before we introduce PrEP at a large scale.
Yeah, and on that note, actually, we tend to hear bad news a lot more than we hear good news, right? Mm. And so you have been watching this unfold over the years since PrEP was brought in, and in fact, harm reduction as well. Would you say that we are not actually hearing enough of the good stories, right, of the religious leaders coming together and understanding and engaging?
Yeah, I think people also need time. That's the thing. Yes, I think because religious leaders have played a phenomenal part in the HIV response, but sometimes they take some time to, and even with some doctors who may be not so agreeable with this initially, history once again teaches us that sometimes people need to take a bit of time. You know, when I started practicing in HIV medicine, even I had my doubts initially as a Muslim, you know, and I'm not far from, I'm not a conservative doctor, but even I had my, but I am a Muslim ultimately, and I wanted to reassure myself that I was also not encouraging things which were against my religion. But I'm very confident that, you know, for example, the discussion around PrEP ultimately prevents an infection which can cause death, disability, and is not pleasant at all if you get it, especially advanced HIV. And I'm very certain that is not just in the interest of patients, public health, but also in my religion, that it needs to be scaled up.
Is it in everyone's interest to reduce HIV? And what I'm trying to get at here is perhaps again that that misconception, the discriminatory perception that HIV only concerns people who are in certain populations, right? It's got nothing to do with me, the general me. Why should we care?
Well, I mean, I think that's the thinking that people, that it's concentrated in key populations. But if you go through a HIV clinic, you know, the faces that you see represent a wide variety of people. You have a young girl, you have a sex worker. They represent different faces behind the disease. And I've lost your question. So maybe can I redirect that to George? Because I've completely... And George has gone all quiet.
Yes.
So I think we need to spice him up a bit.
He's awed by you sharing.
Far from it.
No, I mean, Xiaowei's question actually stunned me and said that, you know, and it is what most people will ask. Her last question was, why should we care? Which was exactly what it is. I mean, if, let's say, you know, earlier on, as an individuals in, you know, in Malaysia, of course, you would think that if this doesn't affect you, and then you can relate to everybody who walked into the HIV clinic, realizing that it is not just the key population are affected, it is the extended families affected.
Absolutely.
And then therefore, when you have that mindset to say, why should we care? Actually, that is, when that's applied to everything else, and if you don't care, the whole society will fall apart. It is not just, the whole idea is not, you don't need to care, but don't abandon the population who are compromised. and don't discriminate that population that's compromised. And more importantly, above all, don't harm that population who are already compromised. Mm. So I think it doesn't matter whether you care or not, but whatever you do, don't prevent that population from getting the right treatment that will save their lives.
Hear, hear. Absolutely. But I will also say, just like George, I think working with populations at risk of HIV and having to deal with a lot of, you know, controversies that have erupted have made me personally a better doctor. You know, you're non-judgmental. And that then extends beyond your work into your personal life. And, you know, you start accepting everybody and appreciating everybody for their diversity. And that's what we want, right? That's how we should be treating everybody.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. And understanding the intersectionality, right, as you said. And interesting, you used the word abandon. We have a WhatsApp message which suggests to reduce the stigma around HIV and AIDS, we should have more friendly advertisements and not like the old times, which showed AIDS patients being abandoned by their family. And that's exactly...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So we need to send those messages which are a bit more, less frightening, you know, more friendly, more savvy. You know, those verbal and visual cues need to be updated as well.
Mm-hmm. And early on, Shawik kind of highlighting the good news. In fact, we have wonderful news about HIV because HIV used to be a death sentence. And you remember in the 80s, that big sign of the grave, you know, the plaque kind of collapse onto you.
Absolutely.
And then that is the vision that most people have.
I still remember that.
Okay. However, we all know that people don't have to die from HIV. We all know that people don't have to die from AIDS if they get the right treatment, right? And then also they live a normal life. And even that is probably the best news that you can imagine, that 40 years down the line, that death is not, AIDS doesn't equal death. But even that good news doesn't infiltrate into people's feel-good factor. It's because of discrimination. It's because of fear. And I think early on, I'm trying to highlight that in a way, it's the key population already bypass all that bias because they survive regardless. And therefore, access to the drugs is one way of them bypassing it. And I think, like you said, people need time. And whenever they realize that an HIV-infected individual, when given the space, the treatment that they deserve, and then they can just live like you and I without fear or without discrimination. And that's a day that probably just takes a long time in a conservative population like Malaysia.
Absolutely. I'm just going to just also raise one point. I've said this twice, I'll say it again. Also, you know, you have this message, U equals U, undetectable equals untransmittable. So a person living with HIV on treatment who continues to take treatment and has an undetectable viral load will not pass the infection sexually to his or her partner. What do we have to be afraid of HIV then? If we ensure that people who are at risk of HIV get tested, treated, on care, and then zero risk of transmission, what do we have to be afraid of anymore? You know? So I think those messages also, and I use every opportunity to remind people about this, because it really should change the face of stigma, and people should not be afraid of HIV knowing this.
So HIV is a chronic disease.
Yes.
Like having hypertension.
Yeah, absolutely, yes. And so, yes. And life expectancy of somebody in care and on treatment equates that to a HIV negative person.
I want to get your final thoughts, Dr. Iskandar. Earlier you said, we've been here before. We've been here before with oral contraceptive pills, with HPV vaccination, and with harm reduction, that moralistic argument, right? What have we learned from history to show us that that same cycle does not have to repeat itself?
So I think as we are all going through this again, and who work in the field of HIV, that people need time, first of all, to digest that, update people around the science, concentrate on the science, leave morality out of the story completely. That is clear, because your public health cap and what the benefit is to the individual and to the public and the larger population at large. I think for countries or for places where they have scaled up PrEP, for example, so like the state of New South Wales, the city of San Francisco, where they already have high treatment coverage for people living with HIV, they are able or looking towards eliminating HIV. So no new cases of HIV. So it depends what the goal is also ultimately. You know, I think we also need to set a target, believe in it, and aim towards that.
Do you believe we can do that?
I think a lot more work needs to be done around stigma and educating all the stakeholders and the general population at large. I think that is the biggest barrier at the moment to us eliminating HIV.
But, George.
Yeah. Well, I've got something that I beg to differ from what you said.
Okay, right. Yeah, go on.
Earlier on, you said the Ministry of Health or public sector actually have a bad name. I beg to differ that. I think UMMC ID department had a wonderful name when it comes to treatment for HIV. I really have clients who come to see me and said, even without HIV, or they take their friends, their relatives over there, just like what you describe, you know, in a place where they feel like there's nobody who's different, nobody's judgmental. And I propose that in many places, let's say, for example, who are well known in an environment like that, like Chelsea and Westminster Hospital in West London, and then they bring their model of how a proper healthcare facility should be like, and then actually disseminate that model to across London. And then so that most people realize that to go and attend a clinic next to somebody who's HIV positive or not, it doesn't matter, because that is the environment that nobody gets discriminated, because it is just like everyone else who walks into the clinic just need treatment. And I think your center in UMMC is doing a wonderful job. And I really think that it's also, providing research because of the number of cases that you come through. And then I really think when you say that public sectors actually get a bad name, I beg to differ, because I think UMMC is doing a wonderful job.
Why, thank you, George. I think that's always a nice way to maybe end a conversation and a dialogue. I think sometimes they get a bad name, and we're always trying to elevate that. But that, I think that, thank you very much. I think it's down to the right team. We have a wonderful team in UMMC, and we're an ever increasing team in terms of size. And both in terms of allied health professionals, doctors and nurses and counsellors, we have a good team there. I don't know what else to say. Thank you very much.
And I think it is your work that also then contributes to the evidence that the Ministry of Health can use to expand PrEP to more public sector clinics, right? And that's what you want to see. You want to see people beyond Klang Valley, not just those who are able to come to UMMC to access this.
And that's the bigger plan, of course, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's time to wrap up this conversation. Thank you so much, Dr. Iskandar, for joining us today. Associate Professor Dr. Raja Iskandar, Raja Azwar, President of the Malaysian AIDS Council, and my co-host, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist. This has been Health and Living on BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.